Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming out, and it's good to see so many of you here. I'm Scott Dowd, and I want to tell you briefly about something new that I'm starting in conjunction with Audience Magazine, called arts-louisville.com, which is going to be my website that will be the place for news, reviews, and interviews about what's happening in the Metro Louisville area. And we're looking to kick that off the beginning of March. So hope that you'll keep an eye out for that. And you'll find more information about it as we get closer to the date in Audience Magazine. But that's all I'm going to say about it for now. I want to introduce you to these two gentlemen next to me. First, we have Jean-Louis Sturman, who I'm sure you have in your collections at home, perhaps some of the Bach recordings or some of the late 20th century music from Naxos and Phillips. And then Andrew Grams, who is our guest conductor for this evening. And thank you both for being here. I really appreciate you taking the time to tell us a little bit about yourselves, your careers, and the music that we're going to hear this evening.
Thank you.
Now, first of all, I really, really am glad to see you because I understand you almost didn't make it to Louisville.
Yes, I'm very happy to be here. I was caught in a storm in Dallas, and the plane I was due to take was canceled. So I was rescheduled for the next plane, the next day, early, and it was canceled. So finally there was a plane that left in the afternoon, and it was not canceled, but there was a problem because some of the crew could not get to the airport. So it was very fraught, and I finally arrived after all rehearsals had been done. And I had a very productive meeting with Andrew, that is actually a fantastic conductor. And he immediately understood everything that we had to do to be together in this, to have an organic and consistent view of the piece. And so he proved to me that rehearsal is unnecessary.
The first time that we all did it together was yesterday morning.
And it went very, very well. It was a great concert. And so we're looking forward to, now that you all have had a chance to do it once, to a great performance this evening.
Yeah. Let's hope that the rehearsal we had yesterday won't spoil it. You know, there is actually something that we don't do in our profession, but that is incredibly enjoyable, which is to have an improvisatory quality to what we are doing, many times because we want to do everything so incredibly perfectly and so cleanly. We may lose slightly spontaneity, mm-hmm. which is actually something marvelous, because I'm sure that at Mozart's time, people would do this concerto sight reading. Mm-hmm. So, no, it was an interesting experience. Very happy to be here in Louisville.
Well, we're glad that you made it. Yeah, Mozart, as a matter of fact, premiered this piece as the soloist, and he probably was improvising and making changes even as he performed it for the first time.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I think that this improvisatory quality that Mozart certainly had to an infinite extent, mm-hmm. is something that we, when we play his concerti, we should certainly aim at or look for.
Yeah. Now, you're also very well known for Bach and for your precision when you play Bach and for staying really true to the music. So there's a little difference when you play Mozart.
No, I think that any music can do with improvisation. Mm-hmm. And I promise you that maybe people would think that my recordings were precise. Of course, they were recordings, and we had to do them a number of times to cover up the imprecisions. But I promise you that any time that I'll play a Bach piece will be different from the previous.
Okay. And you're also very well known for your 20th century works, late 20th century recordings. Tell me a little bit about how you developed your point of view as a musician as to what you were interested in playing.
Mind you, I play any music, and probably the music that I play with the greatest personal satisfaction is really 19th century music, and the romantic music is the music that attracts me personally the most, is the music where I can talk about my sadnesses in the most open way. Mm-hmm. But as a young man, I wanted to be a composer very much. And I studied composition seriously, and I was lucky to have been protected by all the best Brazilian composers that took great care, and I'm really indebted to that. And they showed me what was being done at the time, mm-hmm. and the music that was being done at the time, and they certainly tried to instigate in me an interest for the music of the day, mm-hmm. which I have up to today. I'm very interested in the music that we do today, because I believe that the music that we do today is the music that Chopin and Schumann were doing at that time. Mm-hmm. It is just as important that music keeps moving forward, like history keeps changing all the time. Music keeps changing and goes forward, sometimes backwards, but it keeps moving.
Maestro, tell me a little bit about your approach to the Mozart piano concerto that you all are performing together, and about that conversation that you all had before your rehearsal yesterday morning.
Well, my role, especially in the Mozart concerto, is to support the conception of Jean-Louis. We didn't rehearse with Jean-Louis, but while he was struggling to get here, I did spend some time with the orchestra on the music, you know, the long orchestral bits that they would play alone, and sometimes some of the other places where, you know, perhaps he might do something here, just keep an eye out, look for this, look for that. And after I had worked with them, and I sort of tried to get idea of, you know, Mozart's sound was going to sound very different from the Dvorak sound. After doing that, then when he and I met, he played, and we talked about, you know, the interesting things in the score. You could bring this out, you can bring this out, and this passage here, we could go like this, or we could break it down into little bits. And we just talked and talked and talked. And then what made yesterday morning very fun for me was trying to wordlessly show everything that we had talked about to the orchestra in terms of tempo and sound. And here, let's do this little here and see if I can get them to break this down, even though yesterday I told them to not break it, or, you know, just all of these little things like this. And it's really, really amazing, and quite a testament to the orchestra's ability that so many things popped right off the stick.
Yeah, they're very quick. I mean, they're very, very quick at picking things up. Is this the first time that you all have performed together?
Mm-hmm.
So you were really walking into this blind in a way.
In a way, yeah. That was also the first time I'd ever done this concerto.
Okay, all right. Now, this is a conversation.
That you didn't tell me.
I wasn't going to tell him that.
This is a conversation, and Jean-Louis is going to leave us shortly to go back and get ready for the performance. So if you have questions, or if you have something you'd like to ask, if something you'd like to say, this would be a great time before he leaves us and goes backstage to prepare.
Anything at all.
Well, the theme of the evening is Prague. Mozart, of course, famously said that Pragers understood him. Mein Prager verstehe nicht. They got it. I'm sure you have both performed in Prague.
I've been through the Prague airport.
Has anyone here been to Prague? Have you actually been? Couple of thoughts on the city, on the atmosphere. What did you think?
Absolutely gorgeous place. It's the best place in the world to have a Harley Davidson.
Anyone else care to share a thought on the city? Because this is a beautiful, beautiful city and known as the
nice
conservatory of Europe.
Yeah,
nice concert hall.
Oh, yes, I can't wait to go. I should.
But the first piece, the overture to Don Giovanni that you're going to be performing, how does this tie in with Prague? What's the link thematically?
Well, it's not so much a connection with Prague per se, but we were talking yesterday that overture specifically sets up the piano concerto very, very nicely, and that they're both some of Mozart's more dark pieces, D minor. You know, you have this very, very dramatic, highly agitated overture, especially at the very beginning, with, you know, the lighter Mozartian music that we all know and love, and then that sets up very beautifully the still dramatic but softer but still dark and moody beginning of the piano concerto. Was Don Giovanni premiered? Which one was premiered in Prague?
I think it was premiered in Prague.
I always get all of the De Ponte operas, I get mixed up where they were done first. And I'm pretty sure Don Giovanni was premiered in Prague. Mm-hmm. But Mozart loved Prague, and he really loved the Prague musicians and the audiences, and they loved him also very much so. I think he actually preferred them to the Viennese audiences.
Yeah. And this, you were talking about the key of D minor. This one actually pretty rare for him in his vast repertoire. I think the piano concerto that you're going to play tonight was his first of two in D minor.
Yes. No, this is the only in D minor.
The only
okay.
In D minor.
And, of course, there's a marvelous quartet. Just super quartet. There are some experimental pieces before for piano. And of course, his Requiem is in D minor,
right,
which shows a lot what that key meant to him. It is actually a funny key because Clara Schumann, when she was talking about her husband and he had just written his first trio in D minor, she said, every time he writes in D minor, he shows his soul. Mm. And I believe that it's not only Schumann, Mozart as well. It's a key where the composers will show their soul.
Their soul.
Yeah. Rachmaninoff III.
Very good idea.
Yeah. Which starts almost like the D minor concerto, like the Mozart.
Yeah. Or even the D minor symphony, Schumann.
Oh, yeah,
same
absolutely.
Thing.
Absolutely. No, D minor is a
key. It's a very personal key.
That you can talk about yourself.
Well, it's about
go
19
talk,
after,
talk
so you need to go backstage. But thank you so much for being here.
Yes.
We appreciate your time.
Pleasure to be here.
And we'll look forward to seeing you on the stage this evening.
Come over
I'll
here.
Move over here and be a little bit closer, and we'll talk about Dvorak, who, of course, made his living in Prague, playing the organ and performing as a violist, mm-hmm. with Smetana until he was recognized as a composer. This symphony is very different from the symphony before it and the symphony after it.
The symphony before it was in D minor.
And the symphony before was coming through the death of his mother. The symphony after, of course, the famous New World Symphony, where he was in America and very, very homesick. But this symphony is, very light and very cheerful and sort of full of hope. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts on the work and your preparation for it.
Well, it is a very light, bright piece. G major, it comes from a period in his life where he spent a lot of time in nature and he felt, you know, he started to feel the happy thoughts again. It was also around the same time that he wrote other bright pieces like the Carnival Overture, and things were looking very, very up. Mm-hmm. He was, you know, happy in life. He was doing well. He had gained a significant amount of recognition. And it's a piece that I really like to do. I know a number of people prefer the seventh. A lot of people prefer the ninth. I love the seventh. But the thing about the seventh to me is that when after three great movements, you get to the fourth movement, and that's just kind of a dud. Mm-hmm. I finish the third movement, I go, oh, I got to do the fourth now. Just leave it at that. The Eighth Symphony, I think is a masterpiece. It has invention. It has a wide array of emotions, not just, you know, cheerfulness, not just a simple life, a feeling of contentment, but there are also moments of introspection. There are moments of celebration of what of the Czech spirit, which really comes across, of course, in all of his third movements. But there's when you get to the last movement, which is basically just a set of variations throughout, it just shows a very a masterful command of what it is to craft a symphony, like a skilled woodworker or a skilled engineer. He was able to take something very small and build on it in a beautiful, wonderful way, and we really got a great deal of support from Brahms for this attempt. Right. He tried to write the Seventh Symphony as an homage to Brahms after Brahms had written his Third Symphony, and Brahms didn't really quite know what to make of it too much, but the Eighth Symphony he was quite happy with.
Yeah. Questions? Kathy?
This is not a political statement, and it's not exactly aimed at you. I'm feeling deprived by not having the program notes that I'm using.
Ah, yeah.
And
right.
Therefore, a lot of stuff I don't know. So my silly little question for you is, does the Eighth Symphony have a nickname?
No.
It was briefly known as the English Symphony, which is interesting, because it has absolutely no English qualities to it at all. It was known as the English Symphony because it was published in England, which, you know, is how these things happen sometimes. Haydn's Sun Quartets are the Sun Quartets because when they published them, they put a sun on it. That's it. That's the entire link. No, as a matter of fact, this is probably the most bohemian Czech symphony.
It's full of the hills. It's full of the woods. It's full of, you know, bird trills. It's full of. I was just out today, in forest out there down. Yeah,
Bernheim. Yeah. Oh yeah.
Well, we went past that anyway. That I got a very nice tour of the Maker's Mark distillery. But I was out there amongst the, you know, and you know how it is to get out there. You have to wander around these curvy roads, up and down hills, and the person that was driving said, "Are you sure this is the right way?" I said, "You have to keep the faith." And all of these hills, and you know, sometimes there are woods, sometimes there are wide expanses with cows, sometimes there are horses over there, and you know, I found myself thinking, wow, this must be absolutely gorgeous in the spring and summertime.
It is.
And I said, this is what Dvorak must have thought. Now, I don't think he was drinking spirits at the time. Maybe he was. But this symphony really, you know, it all comes out, that happiness of being alive in a place that you love.
Yeah, yeah. Well, whoever thought to take you out there had a great idea, because you're right. That's exactly what this symphony has in it, and the feeling and the mood. So what a great way to spend the day. And the Maker's Mark Distillery is also fun.
It's very cool. I highly recommend the gift shop. I got to dip my own bottle.
Anyone have a question, a thought? As far as the program notes, we're going to do what we can about that. Of course, you know, things are what they are right now, but we will do what we can about the program notes.
I'm sorry you don't have anything to read during the concert.
But no questions, nothing?
Well, one of the things I always like to see in the program notes are what the orchestration is. How big, how many of this and how many of that. What is the size of the orchestra for this? And are there going to be lots of this or lots of that?
It's very straightforward. The overture has two flutes, two oboes, two clarinets, two bassoons, two horns, two trumpets. I have to do it visually. Two trumpets, timpani, and strings. The piano concerto has one flute, two oboes, two bassoons, two horns, two trumpets, timpani, and the same number of strings. The symphony is, well, this is where we get kind of funny. It has two flute parts, but there are parts where the second flute is supposed to play the piccolo. A lot of orchestras sort of have a dedicated piccolo player, so you're going to see three flutes, but one guy on the end is going to play the piccolo bit. It's also supposed to have two oboes, and the second oboe is supposed to play the English horn literally for three bars. But we have this wonderful lady who's sitting on the end and plays those three bars. So we have three oboes, two clarinets, two bassoons, four horns, two trumpets, three trombones, tuba, and timpani, and the same number of strings.
Mm-hmm. But Dvorak uses the timpani in really interesting ways.
Yeah, in this symphony, it takes, I don't want to say it's a solo role, mm-hmm. but there are, you know, flourishes that pop out of the texture in the timpani in this symphony particularly.
Right, yeah. He's really done a lot to create dramatic tension, too, with the timpani. Let's go back and talk about the Mozart for a minute, because we have just a couple more minutes before you're going to go backstage and get ready to go. And this piece is written, since we don't have program notes, in the typical three movement form. But the second movement, there's a lot going on in the second movement of that piano concerto. We were talking about the key of D minor, but talk a little bit about the movement in the keys and all of the things that are going on and how they're playing against each other in there.
Most of you probably know or have a sense that in symphonies, concertos, and things like this, the choice of keys for all the movements is very deliberate, and they're usually very, very much related. The first movement is in D minor. The last movement is in D minor. The middle movement is in B flat, and it's a very, very famous tune that you all know. You know, a very simple, pure Mozart melody. It's lovely. It has none of the storminess of the first movement, but then there comes this very sharp G minor chord in the strings, which sets off this little middle section where the piano all of a sudden starts doing all of this flurry of activity, and there's a little woodwind counterpoint. If you look at the keys, you have D minor. A third down from that is B flat, and then he goes another third down from that to G minor, which is a relative, the mediant, no, not mediant, the, what's it called, the subdominant, I keep forgetting the names, subdominant to the original key of D minor. But he works his way through various keys, such as E flat major, and then to an E flat dominant seventh, to an E flat diminished seventh, and works his way back to B-flat in an ingenious way, actually. You'll get through all this business, and it'll be flurry activity, blah, 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 and then you'll wind up back in the pastoral area of B-flat without realizing that you've gone through all of these changes, and all of a sudden you're back. It's as if you've gone through a storm, and then all of a sudden the clouds are gone. It's really cool. Super, super cool.
So make sure that when they get to the second movement of the Mozart, you're paying particular attention, because there's a lot going on, and it's really moving really, really fast in some places.
Yeah.
So just heads up that when you get there, it's going to be very cool. So we start tonight.
Another thing that's also very cool is that Mozart from like this concerto on, actually perhaps from like 17, from like the 17th concerto on, his piano concerto started to take on a very, I'll call it like a mini drama. And there'll be like the basic, you know, concerto idea, there's a theme and it's developed, and then there's another theme and these things come together. But with Mozart, from that point on, it's sort of like he'll, in the second movement, there's that mini drama in the middle of this placidity of B flat, and then the action and the storminess of G minor, and then the placidity of B flat again. And then the third movement, it goes back to D minor. It's very, you know, again, there's all that tension in there. And it's a rondo, so the theme will keep coming back. But at the very end, after this cadenza and all of this, then Mozart will sort of go like that. And all of a sudden, D minor becomes D major, and the theme comes, and it's a completely different, almost as if he's thumbing his nose at all the business that's gone on before. So listen for that, especially when you get to the very end, and it builds up to this wonderful big climax, and it just finishes in D major in a great, oh, you're going to love it. You're going to love it.
Any final questions before we let the maestro go back and get ready?
Yeah. I have no idea.
Dvorak? Now, I could have told you Mozart. Mozart was about 29 when he wrote the concerto. This was 1785, but I don't know how old. He wasn't very old when he wrote this symphony.
This is Opus 88. Yeah, I don't know. You're going to have to Wikipedia that.
What I really wanted to ask was,
Right.
Yeah. Right. That was written here.
Right.
The eighth is kind of a celebration of rural life. So, what made him come to the United States, and how long between the finish of the eighth one and the ninth?
I was about to say a work. Work.
Money.
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 Made money.
Him
money
come
brought
to the
him
United
here.
States. He had a chance to teach in Iowa.
And an Iowan.
No. Oh,
Yeah, and I bet there were fewer roads back then.
Yeah,
and probably the same weather though.
Yeah, yeah. He got homesick.
I do have one question.
Yeah, sure.
And I don't know anything about music other than I like it. How do you guys come in? Him from Dallas coming in on a flight. You've been here a couple of days. The orchestra's been here. How do you guys get together and just, you know, make it as good as you make it?
That's what being professional is, I guess.
I'm professional at what I do, but it doesn't sound that good.
What do you do?
I'm a cop.
Well,
see?
You find yourself in stickier situations than I do.
And you probably have to work with people that you haven't worked with before on short notice.
Well, I think we're very lucky to have the chance of hearing two Dvorak in a row. We just had
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, they are so different. What's also very interesting about, especially the symphonies written by the later Romantics, Schumann, Brahms, Dvorak, and on, is that even though you think, well, 7, 8, 9 usually is a trio, but they come from three very separate periods of his life, and they're not written closely together. So you really do get very individual pictures of what everybody's life was like, or what their, you know, what was going on in them at the time that they wrote that symphony, and it just happens to have the number so-and-so. So it's, you know, we think of the collection of four symphonies of Brahms written, and the fact that the first symphony took 20 years to write, and then he didn't pick up another symphony again for God knows how long after that. Same thing with Schumann, same thing with Dvorak. I mean, he wrote the first 4 or 5 fairly quickly, but then he started to really take time in between each symphony and compose a whole number of smaller things, because it's those smaller things that you build on to make the big thing that is the symphony.
I think it was 49.
Ah, 49. There it is.
Thank goodness for iPads.
We love the iPad. 49 years old.
So he was just a kid. Maestro, thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you all.
And break a leg tonight. Thank you.
I will not try.
And I'll give you just a couple of quick program note type of things. 1785 was the year that he wrote the piano concerto. He actually wrote Don Giovanni 1788. Interesting thing to know about Mozart at this time was he was really cementing his friendship with Haydn at the time. And when Haydn heard Don Giovanni, that was his cue to stop writing operas. He heard that work and he just lost his appetite for writing operas. He thought he could never come close to that. And then in the second, after the intermission tonight, we'll be jumping almost exactly a century to the Dvorak. So it's almost 100 years later, and you heard the maestro talking about the relationship between Brahms and Dvorak that mirrors somewhat what was happening with Mozart and Haydn. So important points in both of their lives, and I think that you're going to really enjoy this concert. And I hope that we've answered most of the questions and given you some insight into these works, but you're going to get it all in there because these works are very, very communicative, and they will tell you what they're about. So thank you all for being here, and don't forget to come back. The end of this month, the 26th, is Paris, and we will see you all then.